Well, welcome to the Faith Element podcast for the November 15, 2015 session, focusing on 1 Samuel 1, verses 1 through 28, Hannah's Anchor. I'm David Cassidy, and I work with the great team here at Faith Lab. I'm joined for this episode by our good friends Nikki Hardiman and Bert Montgomery. How are you guys doing this evening?
Pretty good. How are you, David?
Doing well.
Hey, David.
I'm also excited to again welcome Aaron Hall back to the podcast. Aaron, if you remember, is a writer, mother to Logan, and a doctoral student at Columbia Seminary. If you want to follow her work, she writes at her blog at aaronrobinsonhall.com. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Now, as we're recording this episode, it's actually the Thursday before Halloween. So I'm really curious what Logan is planning to wear this Halloween.
Logan will tell you that he is going to be the Wolverine. I didn't realize that the Wolverine's name is Logan, like the comic book Wolverine, but he is very excited about that. He is 3 years old, and he will tell anybody in the grocery store what he's going to be.
He's excited. That's great.
That's great. The Wolverine.
All right. Well, Bert, can you get us started with some beginning thoughts on the text for today?
Well, I can try. I don't really know where to start. There's a whole lot in today's story that any number of contemporary activists could seize upon. Patriarchy and polygamy, merciless teasing and emotional abuse, not to mention the unmistakable assumption that breastfeeding is a perfectly natural thing which shouldn't make us uncomfortable. Just saying. But what we do have here is the beginning of a sweeping epic tale of power, corruption, lies, murder, war, peace, love, hope, sin, and salvation. King Saul and King David and eventually King Solomon and all their stories for good and for ill are a part of the epic tale that is about to unfold in this book. And it begins, like that of the New Testament stories, with an unimportant woman. Here the woman's name is Hannah, which means favor or grace. Hannah is one of two wives married to a man named Elkanah. The other wife is Peninnah. The religious and social teachings of the day treated Peninnah as the more valued one, the more important wife, and certainly the more blessed by God, because she bore children. And Peninnah reveled in that fact and took great joy in taunting Hannah endlessly because Hannah had been unable to have children. Hannah bears her soul before God, unloading her emotional pain, her feelings of abandonment and worthlessness, the bitterness that is built up in response to the society's view of her, and especially the bitterness that is built up in response to the bullying she's taken from Peninnah, and she makes a deal with God. Oh God, if you take a good look, hard look at my pain, if you will quit neglecting me and go into action for me by giving me a son, I'll give him completely and unreservedly to you. That's from the Message. We also meet Eli, the high priest of the temple, who is unable to recognize sincere emotional prayers from the depths of the heart, and he assumes this pitiful woman is drunk, and he treats her as such. We go on. God answers Hannah's prayer. She conceives a son with Elkanah, and she names him Samuel, which means God heard. And she stayed home with him and nursed him. And when he was weaned, she took Samuel back to Shiloh, dedicated him to the Lord, and Samuel then grew to become the last of the judges over Israel and the one through whom God would name a king. The humble one, Hannah, had been lifted up, and the proud wife, Peninnah, had been humbled. And that theme flows throughout the epic story that follows.
That was a very good introduction.
Yeah, I felt
good.
Like we needed dramatic music underneath it or something.
I know. Bert, that was a great way to introduce the story. I think that when we look at these stories in the Old Testament, in Faith Element all the time, we talk about context. So we have specifics of the stories that are important, but we also have to consider where they sit in the canon of scripture and the impact that they have on stories coming after them and how they're influenced by stories that came before them. And I think that this, I love that you set it up, how this story really begins the next chapter for the nation of Israel. It is the beginning of the story of how we have kings, and Samuel, the son that is eventually born to Hannah, ends up playing a role in the Hebrew scriptures that I think we often take for granted or maybe don't understand the power and impact of that. He is given the titles at different points along his story of judge and priest and prophet. And so he plays all three of these very pivotal roles in the nation of Israel. And I think that when we can begin to see and understand stories in that larger context, we can understand them better.
Isn't it tremendous, though, that something that big, all of those roles and that bigger story can be born of someone who is having trouble giving birth to someone at all? I mean, her worth was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, infertility, we can talk about it today, but then it was, she has no worth, but yet this whole story is born from her suffering.
Right. I think, you know, one of the big parts of this story is the way that women in the nation of Israel relate to motherhood. There's many stories of infertility, and I think we often put our own experience of that on it, but I don't know that there's any way for us to really understand, though there may be places in our world where it is still true, but that a woman's worth was directly and pretty much only connected to their ability to become mothers.
And we say worth, we hear, you know, today, like our emotional mm-hmm. worth and that kind of thing. No, her very security,
yeah.
mm-hmm. you know, it was a very different
context.
It was
a practical financial worth.
Yeah, the worth and value that she would be to her husband. And theologically, it's not that God, not simply that God has not blessed her with kids, but barrenness was seen that God actually mm-hmm. cursed her.
Right.
So there's something wrong with her that she offended God to begin with, mm-hmm. apparently.
It was because of her behavior and sin, and it was her fault.
Yeah.
That God did this to her. And that's in the text. I mean, that's in this text today.
Yeah.
And she would have felt that. She would have wondered, what did I do to make this happen?
Yeah, and y'all could speak to this. I imagine that that's part of her prayer, even though it's not recorded. But part of the exact words, I mean, it is. But I would imagine that the magnitude of the prayer that she prays when she goes there involves questioning God. What have I done? You know, all the emotion is coming out. Why is this happening to me? Why can't I have kids? And raising a fist at God.
I do think there's a seeking mercy, which I think connects to that, you know. God have mercy, make this possible. I mean, she was bullied and outcast. And I think it's that we understand the story better when we can really get in touch with Hannah's place, when we can, as much as we're able, understand the pain and abuse that she experienced.
So let's look at some of the things that she did. I mean, from the text, I mean, we get a picture here of, you know, she had these routines, she had rituals she was a part of, and these people in her life. Okay, starting in verse 3, this man used to go up year by year. Like, they had this ritual, and every year she had to face, you know, the abuse, and
yeah,
it was miserable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I really love the footnote about, I mean, it's not a footnote, but it's, you know, this kind of, Elkanah loved her and gave her a double portion. I mean, you know, it's, he wanted this for her. I kind of imagine him as a fixer. You know, what can I do to make this better? But woefully unaware of what she really felt and experienced. But trying to respond, I guess, in the way that he thought he should and could respond. But she did. Every year they went up to make these sacrifices, and every year her prayer over and over and over and over again. Give me a child, Lord. Give me a child. And I imagine that that is a common experience for women who, and dare say even couples who, and it's kind of taking it present day, but that experience of over and over and over again, God, please, this month.
Yeah.
I imagine that rituals develop around issues of infertility today, even as they did for Hannah then.
I don't have to go very far to imagine. This story is very deeply personal to my family. I have no idea what it is to have your fertility, your ability to build a family, you know, you're very security based on that. I have no idea what that's like, but I do know what it's like to every year face this event, to every month hope for this. Just a little bit of backstory. My husband and I, it took us 6 years to bring our son into the world. And in that time, we faced a lot of different infertility struggles and surgeries and ended up getting infertility treatments. And we have been blessed with, like I said earlier, the most amazing little three-year-old. And then we're crazy enough to try for round two of this, to try the infertility roller coaster again. And it's when Logan was about a year old, to start this over. And, you know, you'd think we have it all down, and it's a completely different ball game this second time that has involved more cost. I'm older this time, pregnancy loss, and still ridiculous, stupid questions. so, you know, when I hear the story of Hannah, I think about, you know, it's cruel enough that she couldn't have children. You know, we don't know why. We don't know what her situation was. But that she had these people, like Nikki said, trying. That, you know, Elkanah wanted to do something, so I'm sure that he was trying to maybe be a fixer. Cruelty doesn't often happen just directly. Sometimes it's just the things people say that are thoughtless. I don't know if you've ever had, you know, words come at you that are just hurtful, but the person has no idea that they're hurtful. Have you guys ever had that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I remember we were about year two or three. Just kind of realizing, okay, this is what we're facing with infertility. And we hadn't even gotten into like the IUI treatments or anything like that. And, you know, God love her heart, I was handed at a family gathering. My sister-in-law handed me a baby doll from her daughter and said, here, hold this. You know, maybe you need a little practice. Ouch. And she was joking. She was making light of it. And we've since talked about this. But jokes and small comments, or even ways to understand what's going on by those little platitudes. Like, if you just relax, it'll happen. Cause definitely science says that, you know, or, you know, just when you least expect it, it'll happen. Actually, probably not. Because, you know, when you are facing infertility, there's things you know. Like Nikki was referencing, you know the day and the time, you know where you are in the 2-week wait. You know what you're, you know, exactly what shots you'll get on what day.
Yeah. First, thank you for being honest and candid with your story. You know, when I remember when I began the process of, my husband and I began the process of starting a family. I was at that age, and a lot of my friends were as well. And we've had our own pain related to this, not infertility for us, but we lost an infant. And what you learn is that this life experience that is supposed to bring joy and does in so many ways is also completely fraught with anxiety and pain and loss for so many people in lots of different ways and contexts. And if it's not me that has dealt with it, I know someone who has dealt with it. and I have listened to their pain, and it's everywhere. Even in today's medical world, when we can take care of so many things, because I think creating a family comes with so much hope and desire, and there's expectation wrapped up in it, our own and society's, and while today I don't think we can always connect with Hannah's lack of insecurity or lack of security based on not having a child. I'm talking like financial, when you get older, security. You know, that's not something that's present for all of us, at least in the developed world. We do know what it means to be the ones who have lost a baby or to be the ones who can't get pregnant. And the way that people treat you different and the way they talk to you differently. And there's all kinds of little things that are there.
There are a thousand events and triggers and just the smallest things that seem like normal life when you are longing for something and you cannot reach that thing. It can just be cruel to have to walk through those moments, and it doesn't make sense. And I think that is what strikes me even in the text here, is people, they're trying to make sense of their world in the way they knew it. So they said, okay, well, you don't have a baby, it's because of your sin. Well, we don't necessarily say that today, but we do have these ways of understanding the world that, and you know, even when you have a couple, you know, as they become a couple, they become a family, you know, we still say, well, when are you going to start a family? What does that even mean? I mean, was your family not started when you covenant together?
It's interesting. This text comes up. This discussion is coming up right where we are in this part of the semester in my class, marriage and family class, that I'm teaching, because the chapters of this week and the week before are dealing with courtship and intimacy and then marriage and having children. And in American culture, of course, we have a growing number of people who we're prolonging. Not only are we're delaying marriage until older ages so we can get through with school and get our careers going, we're delaying having children. Mm-hmm. And some of us are deliberately choosing not to have children.
Yeah,
right.
And that's a factor. And it's not that they can't. They're choosing
not to.
Mm-hmm. And there was a story in my textbook about a family who was like, the assumption is there's something wrong with you if you're married and not having kids. Do you need to see a specialist or something? No, we choose not to have kids. And so the whole cultural concept and how that you know, affects how we treat each other and the assumptions we make. But I want to go back to the idea of children as blessings from God and not having children as a curse from God, because one of the dangerous things, dangerous theologies that I have seen coming back into play in the recent decade in a growing evangelical circles is that idea, the full quiver movement.
Quiverful,
yeah. And in mainstream circles. So the idea, no birth control, you have kids. Every child you have is a blessing from God. The thing that is not spoken to those families, and if I was a wife in that situation, if I'm not able to have kids, that means something's wrong with me, and God is choosing not to bless us.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's a very dangerous thing.
That's what goes with that. So,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I think that's very dangerous. And I think it, you know, all of this brings to question, how do we understand family? How are families made? And if I would say, you know, the whole story of God is making family where there was no family, or and turning around the definition of family. Turning around who's included and drawn in. And, you know, we almost have this, we think that when I use the word covenant, that's how I understand marriage, but we go into this relationship to build a family, and we think it's a contract, a guarantee for here's what your life will look like. You know, mm-hmm. you get together, you get married, you give it a couple of years, work all the kinks out, and then you get kids.
Right.
When it doesn't work, we think that one side of the contract has not been fulfilled. And nobody ever gave you that contract. I don't know where we got that from.
Yeah.
But I think that's true for any kind of brokenness that happens in families. It's not just infertility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's sorrow in this text that we can understand from divorce, from any number of loss, that we look at this sometimes and say, okay, who broke the contract and how do I fix it? How do I, you know, sue for damages?
Right. Well, and when we hold up this ideal of family, especially in a world where very few families look just like that. I mean, I think that that's actually not the norm for what families look like. Sometimes it's because a marriage doesn't work. And so
or shouldn't work.
Or, right, you know, shouldn't work, you know.
There are times when they, I will say, are better not together.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I have a friend who she never found someone to marry, but she really wanted children. And so she adopted, but she had to deal with people judging her because she adopted a child without a husband, and she's perfectly capable.
How dare she?
Right. And she's perfectly capable and is doing a wonderful job raising that beautiful daughter of hers. You know, never mind the fact that she gave a home to someone who needed it. You know, I think that we hold up this old idea of what family is supposed to look like. But the truth is, families take 100 different shapes. And what about the person who chooses not to get married and doesn't have a family and they're single, living alone? You know, their family is comprised of people they choose and family of origin, and we don't validate that. We don't honor that as valid. Those people are family-less.
Which is ironic, isn't it? Since, I mean, among Christians, because that is what Paul said we should do, right?
Right? Yeah, it's true.
Remain single.
Yeah, that's what Paul said.
It's all about Paul.
We do like to pick and choose, though.
Well, and you know, and again, the sociologist in me is coming out as we're talking about how we think about family has changed. You know, a single woman, same-sex couples adopting children, or having children through
IVF.
Exactly.
A lot of friends have done that.
And before we say, well, the old traditional biblical family value, I mean, right, we've got polygamy, so.
There you go.
And it's not judged as wrong.
No,
he's
not.
Doing the proper thing, and he's got two. It's like the old country song: "Trying to love two women is like a ball and chain." Right? That's before your time.
Wow,
David might know
there.
That one.
Yeah, he did.
That's an old country song. I'm just saying.
I'm curious about, you know, because I've not experienced this. My family has not experienced this, so I have no way to directly relate to it. But I wonder. You know, because I hear the deep emotion. How does one deal with that? And from as a person of faith, how do you deal with that? And I guess connected to that is what can, should the church do? Can the church do anything to be helpful?
I think we see some of it in the story. I mean, Hannah prayed. Hannah went to church, and Hannah reached out to God, and I had never noticed this until I was preparing for Faith Element, but her sadness left before she even tried to get pregnant again. She found a peace that came even in the midst of her barrenness. And I think that even though Eli at first does not respond well, eventually he understands and listens and validates her. And I think that Hannah held on to something bigger. And I think that's hard to do. I think that's not an easy thing to do. But I think Hannah holds up a picture for us of where to start.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Nikki. But I guess I've heard this used by male pastors to tell women struggling with getting pregnant, go and pray. And, you know, maybe you're not praying hard enough and all that. And look, Hannah got pregnant. you know, here's your example. And what the negative side of that is, if we use this as an example, what about the woman who's right. praying earnestly and yeah. doesn't get pregnant anyway?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I point out her peace did not come from getting pregnant. She found it before she even laid with her husband. It's she goes and does that after the sadness leaves her.
Well, her peace came from being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And bringing that vulnerability mm-hmm. right into the middle of the worship yeah. space. She is having it out with God. And I personally, I mean, you asked how does a person of faith do this? Moment by moment, not even day by day, because the moments hit you so hard. And there is this brick wall you kind of build up around yourself, at least we did, especially since we were not only people of faith, but trying to lead faith communities. We were both serving as ministers, you know, these first few years of infertility. And God, that's hard to keep speaking faith and speaking hope to other people when you are just flat out of it that day. But I can remember, I call it my flower in the cross moment. One Easter Sunday morning, you know, ministers love Easter morning for lots of reasons, but one part that was not my favorite was the sunrise service. And so, you know, you're up before Jesus is arose or whatever. And so, you know, we're never on time anywhere. So we're flying out the door. I've got the flower for the flower cross. And I don't know if you've seen these before, but it's a, you know, in our case, it was made of chicken wire, but people bring their flower from their home, from their garden, whatever. And the day before, you know, I'm kind of dreading Easter anyway, because I know that we have lunch with friends with small children. And so there was that whole thing. And so Jake says to me, do we have a flower? Well, crap. Let me think of one more thing. So I grabbed this tulip out of our front yard that I had planted, you know, 2 years before, and it finally bloomed. I snatched that sucker up and I kind of threw it in my bag ready to go in the morning. So Easter morning comes and it's a work day for us. So we're flying out the door and Jake goes, I forgot something at the church. And we're going to a community Easter sunrise service. So we have to go not to the church, but further. So we stop at the church and he runs downstairs to get whatever it was, you know, Lord help us. And it's 6 a.m. and the church is dark and I am angry. I'm angry with the whole year we had faced. I'm angry of one more month that it was a big fat no for us. And instead of sitting in the car, I decided I'm freezing cold. So I marched into the sanctuary and there was that chicken wire cross. And I just looked at it and I stared at it. And I was at the back of the sanctuary and I can remember marching in my pink sweater and high heels down to the front of the church in the dark. And I'll tell you, I let everything left it right there. If Eli had come up at that moment, he would have said I was drunk. But I had some words for God. And I think in that moment of vulnerability, I let loose some things that I wasn't able to let go of any other place but at the foot of the cross in that moment. And I took my little tulip and I shoved it, like I broke the stem in the middle of the stinking cross. And so then I marched out and we had our stuff. We went on with Easter. But I watched later as people brought their own flowers and it kind of filled in all around the tulip. But that stubborn tulip was right there in the middle of the cross, like odd. Like it was so awkward just sticking out. And that is still my favorite liturgical symbol of all time, that I can bring all this crap. I mean, I yelled the ugly words at the Lord. But I think that kind of vulnerability is how you get further. And so I think Hannah's prayer here, that's a model for us. So in talking about that, having this moment on Easter Sunday morning, not many people who are facing infertility get those moments, but I think we have to make space for them in the church. And a really great resource for that is Project Pomegranate. And they have, if you ever get a chance to check out their website, resources for people who are going through infertility, but also churches and ministers, and how do we show up for these people and give them space to scream at God. So Project Pomegranate, great resource.
Thank you for that, Erin. We'll certainly link up that project in the show notes so people can find that. Sounds like a good and needed resource. Thank you so much for sharing. I know it's not always easy to share something that intimate and that close, but I know it's helpful to hear how others process these hard spots in life. And I do appreciate you sharing that with us and being vulnerable with us as well. Well, thank each of you for your time this evening and for this conversation. I hope this is a conversation that will continue not only among us, but among the church in general, because it does sound like a place that that needs to continue as a place of ministry and hope. And I guess I'll conclude with this. After hearing your story, Erin, I am grateful that we have a God that can handle us being angry and sharing our deepest angst and anger. That is a good thing.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Good night, y'all. Have a good one.
Good night.
Good night, David.
Find more information about this podcast, as well as videos and teaching resources for this session, at faithelement.net. Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.